Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Basketball and Other Things, a collection of questions asked, answered, illustrated, overtime edition. By Shea Serrano. Narrated by Sean Crisden. An Introduction by way of 10 questions. 1. Didn't this book already come out? Yes, in 2017. 2. Why are you re-releasing it? The original version of this book was a paperback. After it did well, a publisher decided that its follow-up, 2019's Movies and Other Things, needed to be released as a hardcover. I threw a great big fit about the two books not matching, and so now that's why this one is getting re-released as a hardcover. So that they match. 3. Is there stuff in this new version that isn't in the old version? A couple of things, yes. I added some names here and there, and also I wrote 2 new chapters. By and large, though, it's the same. As such, this version is mostly going to be optimal for people who either A, don't already own Basketball and Other Things, or B, you do own it but are bothered by the fact that it doesn't match Movies and Other Things. Which, to be frank, should be everyone, because it's absolutely insane to me that someone wouldn't be bothered by that. To be fair, one time I also spent 8 minutes making sure my shoes were tied exactly the same amount of tightness, so perhaps I'm not the best person to judge which small things make sense and which don't. 4. Will you tell me a little about the book? Sure. The book has 35 chapters. Each chapter is the answer to a different basketball question, and they're not traditional, normal, regular questions. They're not things like, "Was Larry Bird better than Magic Johnson?" They're new questions, questions that you've hopefully not seen before or thought about before. Oh, also, the questions are not related to each other, and what I mean when I say that is the book isn't a thing that has to move front to back. It doesn't flow from one chapter to the next like the way a regular book would. In most cases, you don't have to read one chapter to read a chapter that comes after it. You can jump in wherever. Oh, another also, there's a lot of art in here, and also some charts. That part doesn't really need to be explained, though. 5. Is the book all NBA-related stuff? Pretty much, yes. There are 2 chapters that are about pickup basketball, and there's 1 chapter that's about an NBA player who's not an NBA player anymore. And there are, of course, some WNBA mentions, and there's a section about basketball players from TV shows and movies, but other than that, yes, it's all NBA-related stuff. 6. What did you mean in your answer to the 4th question when you said, in most cases you don't have to read one chapter to read a chapter that comes after it? Why the in most cases? Well, some of the questions ended up requiring answers that were way longer than I was anticipating. And so I just took them and say, rather than having a single chapter that was 6,000 words, I'd take it and break it into 2 chapters that were 3,000 words. So there are some double chapters in here and even a couple of triple chapters, which is truly dumb. 7. Since it's a basketball book, am I going to have to know a lot about stats or learn a lot about stats? There are stats that get mentioned in the book, definitely. Mostly it's just regular stuff, points per game, blocks per game, things like that. But there are some spots that reference advanced stats to help prove a point or strengthen a point. Here's a quick summary for you. Player efficiency rating, PER. This one uses a calculation of all the pieces of the traditional box score to tell us how efficient a player is. The average NBA player has a PER of 15. All-star players are usually around or above 20. League MVPs tend to hover near 27.5. Anything above 30 is exceptional. The highest ever PER was 1963 Wilt Chamberlain, 31.82. Box plus minus, BPM. This is a box score-based measurement that estimates a player's performance relative to the league average, and it's expressed on a per 100 possessions basis. What that means is, okay, if a player has a BPM of 5, that means he is 5 points better than an average player over 100 possessions. Anything above 8 is very good, and anything in double digits is unquestionable. The highest ever BPM was 2017 Russell Westbrook, 15.6. Value over replacement player, VORP. This converts BPM into an estimate of each player's overall contribution to the team. So basically, it tells us how valuable a player is versus replacing that player with someone else, or a replacement player, in this case defined as a minimum salary player not in a rotation. Same as BPM, anything above 8 is very good, and anything in double digits is unquestionable. The highest ever VORP was 2017 Russell Westbrook, 12.4. Win shares, WS. This is an estimate of the number of team wins a player is responsible for on his team during a particular season. If you add up all the win shares on a team, it'll equal up to somewhere near however many games that team won that season. Anything near 15 typically means an MVP caliber season. 1972, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar had the highest WS ever at 25.37. Now, one of two things just happened in that stats section. Either you started reading it and were like, wow, this is interesting. Or you started reading it and were like, nah, fuck this, and then skipped it. If you're in that second group, all you need to know is that whenever a stat gets mentioned somewhere, high numbers are good and low numbers are bad. 8. The phrase, and other things, that appears in the title of this book. What does it mean? On occasion, some of the basketball conversations in here will go sideways for a second. The reason I did it that way is because that's how talking about basketball works for me, which means that's how writing about basketball works for me. I don't think I have ever had a conversation about basketball that traveled in a perfectly straight line. I suspect it works that same way for a lot of people. The talks always kind of veer off in different directions, touching on this thing or that thing along the way before arriving at the conclusion. So I wanted to be careful to keep that feeling intact and that spirit intact. It just felt natural. 9. You mentioned earlier that this isn't a history book. Was there a cutoff point in time that you decided on? What I did is I just traveled backwards to 1980, the season that Larry Bird and Magic Johnson entered the league, which was the birth of the modern NBA. And then I walked forward from there. There are tiny pieces and footnotes that reference moments from before then, but all of the bigger thoughts and questions and ideas are built up around people and things from 1980 forward. 10. Why did you ask Reggie Miller to write the foreword? I grew up in San Antonio, and so the Spurs were, of course, my favorite basketball team growing up and still are my favorite basketball team now. Reggie was the first basketball player I ever loved. I remember watching him play a game on TV in middle school in the mid-90s and just being absolutely in awe. He was doing all of the things I thought were cool, shooting threes, talking shit, shoving people, etc. And when you're 13, 14, 15 years old, the only stuff that matters to you is stuff that's cool, you know what I'm saying? He was a king to me, a basketball lord of sorts. I watched Reggie without fail for a good decade after I found him, all the way up until his retirement in 2005. His last game was a loss to the Pistons in the playoffs. In the final seconds, Pacers coach Rick Carlisle called a timeout so he could take Reggie out so the crowd could cheer for him. Reggie walked toward the bench and raised his hand, and everyone was just glowing with love, and it was this very touching, very moving scene. And right when it was about to end, Larry Brown, who was coaching the Pistons, called a timeout too. And the only reason he did was so everyone could keep cheering for Reggie. The camera cut to the crowd, and it was person after person after person in tears. Even after all these years, it remains the only time I ever cried while watching someone's final game. I didn't know in that moment I'd eventually write a book about basketball and that Reggie would write the foreword for it, but I did know I was going to carry Reggie in my heart forever, and that basketball meant more to me than I'd allowed myself to realize. Foreword by Reggie Miller. I have a memory from before I was in the league that I think about to this day. I hope I'm right on the dates here. This was in 1986. It was a Sunday, and it was during the playoffs. I woke up that morning. This must have been my junior or senior year at UCLA. I remember waking up and getting ready to watch the CBS game. It was between Chicago and Boston. It was the game where Jordan scored 63, the one where he went crazy, the famous game. I remember just lying in bed watching it. By that point, I felt like I was going to be drafted, or I was assuming I was going to be drafted. You're never totally sure that you're going to be in the NBA until you're actually in the NBA. But I definitely thought I could play there. So there's that connection there between me and the NBA because I know, or I hope, I'm going to be a part of it soon. And I'm watching the game, and I'm shaking my head. I'm looking at Michael Jordan, and, I mean, Jordan was playing at such a high level. I was like, I can't believe what I'm witnessing. It was like 1-on-5. He was just 2 steps faster than everyone on the court. And I'm thinking, how is this humanly possible? I had played against him in a pickup game once or twice at UCLA during the summer, and I'd also met him when he and my sister both won the Naismith Award. So I'm watching him, and I'm like, I know I guarded him better than that. This is unbelievable what I'm watching. Usually, you watch a game and you come in and out and you're doing other things. But that game, I remember just being fixated on the TV. That's one of the games that always stood out to me because he was playing like he just wasn't from this world, if that makes any kind of sense. My friends were going to eat. They were trying to go out. They were asking me to go with them. And I was like, what? No, go. Leave me alone. Just go. I couldn't take my eyes off the TV. I've seen so many games. I've watched so many great players. But it was something about that game, about that performance. I think part of it was, of course, because of how great he was playing. But also another part was how I was feeling about becoming a part of that world. It was this really overwhelming feeling of knowing. It felt good. It felt surreal. I'll never forget that. During my 4 years at UCLA, every summer in the men's gym, we played these pickup games. They weren't just normal pickup games, though. Our UCLA team, we stayed together and we played on one team, okay? And we were good. But there were all these pros that would come through and play, too. Magic was always there and he had a team. Isaiah Thomas and Mark Aguirre would be there and they'd have a team. Kiki Vandeweghe would have a team. And there was a team of overseas players. Larry was there. Michael showed up a couple times. Everyone came through because during the summer, everyone was in L.A. So we had all these different teams with all these different pros, and we all played round robin on two courts. It was absolutely the best basketball I had ever seen. I mean, it was Magic and Kareem and all these guys unscripted, uninterrupted. Everyone was just flowing. Think about that. Think about being 20 years old and you're playing pickup basketball with Magic Johnson, with Larry Bird, with Michael, with Kareem. That's what we were doing. 2.5 to 3 months out of the year, that's what we were doing. It was pure. There's something to be said of those moments where you're on the bus or you're on the plane or you're in the locker room with your team and you're just laughing and vibing off one another. Just being in the back of the bus with the LaSalle Thompsons, the Mark Jacksons, the Vern Flemings, the Herb Williamses, the Chuck Persons. It's an incredible experience. That's a part of the NBA that a lot of people never get to see, so I guess maybe that's what makes those memories feel so special. They belong to so few people. I remember being on the bus in the back during my rookie year, and it was our first road trip. I'm 22 years old, and Clint Richardson, I remember this story so vividly, he pulled me aside. This was when he was in his last year in the league, or close to his last year, I believe. He pulled me aside, and he said, "Look, be yourself. Don't be a follower. Be a leader. You don't have to dress like everyone else. Be unique in this league." That sounds like real general or basic advice, but to hear it from a veteran when you're a rookie, that's a big thing. It's a big moment. It was a real big moment for me. John Long, who was my mentor my rookie year, he was 31 at the time, and I was 22. He was the shooting guard. I only started one game that season. He started all the other games. And before every game, we would sit down and we would watch tape of the opposing guard and we would talk about how we were going to guard him. And for a guy that had been in the league for as long as he had, he was there for like a decade before I got there, for him to sit down with a rookie who was going to take his spot eventually and teach me what the NBA was, it was incredible. "Reg, you can't talk to Alvin Robertson." "Reg, this is how we're going to guard Ricky Pierce." "Reg, you see how Randy Whitman is using the screen here? Look at his arms. You want to knock his arms down and lock and go on this one." "Reg, when you play Ron Harper, you're going to want to play physical with him, but be smart. You're going to hold him with your left hand and keep your right hand up because the ref is right behind you and he's looking at your right hand." It was those lessons that were invaluable as a rookie. And more than that, it is those things that I remember the most. The shots are great, you know. Hitting big shots against the Knicks and the Nets and the Sixers and the Celtics and the Bulls, those were great. Those are the things everyone talks about, the things everyone asks about. But it's those little lessons I learned from John Long, from Byron Scott, who came to our team in the mid-90s and really made us feel like we could win in the playoffs, from anyone who sat down and just talked in private. Those are the special moments. It's those things that I'll remember and always look back on so fondly. During the first lockout year, I got cast in a small part in Gang Related, a movie starring Jim Belushi and Tupac. It was shot out in L.A., and my whole scene was, I think I was a hot dog vendor. That was my part. But I was playing Reggie Miller as a hot dog vendor because of the lockout. And the whole scene with Jim Belushi was like, "Oh, God, it must be really hard out here for you right now, Reggie." And I was supposed to be like, "Well, I gotta find extra money doing something." That was the whole thing. It was real short. But still, it was just so cool to be on set. And then when Tupac showed up, it was like he just took the whole set to another level. His voice, that voice alone would just get you hyped for every take, every scene. And he and I would talk, and he was a big basketball fan, so we had that instant connection over our love of the game of basketball. Of the four sports, I think it's easiest for basketball to become absorbed into other parts of pop culture, because think about it. A lot of times people aren't going out to play a casual game of baseball. It's not a thing you can just jump up and do. Everyone's got to have a glove. There's got to be a big field. And with football, it takes a lot of people to play a game. Basketball, though, you don't really need much beyond a ball and something to throw it in. You can play it one-on-one, two-on-two, three-on-three. It's just an easy game to access. Plus, the players are in jerseys and shorts. You can see them. They're very recognizable. A football player has to wear a helmet all the time. Baseball players have hats on, and their uniforms also feel a little more official. Basketball, to me, it just feels more accessible. It feels more available. Go back to grade school. Other than playing on the monkey bars, what was everyone doing? You could always find a bunch of kids playing basketball on the blacktop. So whether you played or just watched, we all grew up with it. Somehow, it just becomes a part of everything. Of music, of movies, of television. Even when it isn't the main focal point of what's happening. It's there, somewhere. Maybe in the background, or even behind the background. It's there. Basketball is always there. 1. What year was Michael Jordan the best version of Michael Jordan? Let's you and I concede a point. Let's you and I agree that Michael Jordan, generally regarded as the greatest basketball player of all time, is exactly that. The greatest basketball player of all time. Perhaps you don't believe that. And if you don't, then that's fine. Perhaps you think it's Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was an excellent player for longer than anyone else ever was an excellent player. Or perhaps you think it's Wilt Chamberlain, who once averaged over 50 points and 25 rebounds for an entire season. Which is all the way unbelievable. Or perhaps you think it's Greg Oden, the first ever number one NBA draft pick to have a picture of his penis posted on the internet. Maybe there's a chance you think it's Magic Johnson, the best ever at controlling the flow of a game. LeBron James, the best ever at being great at all the positions. Tim Duncan, the best ever at being the love of my life and also some basketball things. All of those are fine choices. And if one of those, or anyone else, is your pick for greatest ever, let's pretend, at least for the duration of this chapter, that you, like me, think it's Jordan. That being so, here's the question. If Michael Jordan is the greatest basketball player of all time, then what year was it that Michael Jordan was the best version of Michael Jordan? When was the greatest basketball player of all time at his absolute greatest? To figure out what season Michael Jordan was the best version of Michael Jordan, we have to examine four different things. The box score stats, specifically his points, rebounds, assists, blocks, and steals averages. Rather than take straight game averages, though, let's do it based on per 100 possessions, which helps to evaporate away most variations that might otherwise pop up because of changes in playing time or game pace. The advanced stats I explained in the section prior to this first chapter, player efficiency rating, box plus minus, value over replacement player, win shares. His playoffs performance each season, which, at least in a certain measure, is generally more important than regular season performance. Any additional or extenuating factors that might have affected a season's arc, or even a single game's arc, like the time he put up 38-7-5 in Game 5 of the 1997 NBA Finals when he had the flu, which remains iconic. Or the time when, at the end of a game against the Nuggets in 1991, he shot a free throw with his eyes closed just to needle then-rookie Dikembe Mutombo, which remains cool. Or the time during a game against the Jazz in 1987 when a Jazz fan sitting near courtside shouted at him to pick on someone his own size after he'd dunked on John Stockton, 6'1". To which Jordan responded by dunking over the nearly 7-foot-tall Mel Turpin on the next possession and then shouting, "Is that big enough?" at the fan, which remains hilarious. Jordan played 13 seasons with the Bulls. That means there are 13 versions of Michael Jordan for us to pick from. However, one of those was the season he returned from his first retirement, 1995 Jordan, and not including the playoffs, he only played 17 games that year, so we can eliminate that one. That leaves us with 12 different versions of Michael Jordan. Of those, one Jordan was great, two Jordans were very great, six Jordans were very, very great, two Jordans were very, very, very great, and one Jordan was the greatest. They're arranged here by ascending greatness. The Great Michael Jordans. Season 1985-86. Advanced stats. Win shares, 1.5. Box plus minus, 4.7. Value over replacement player, 0.8. Player efficiency rating, 27.5. Per 100 possessions, 43.5 points, 6.8 rebounds, 5.7 assists, 2.2 blocks, 3.9 steals. Team playoff success. Lost to the Celtics in the first round, 3-0. Three significant things happen this year. First, Jordan breaks his foot 3 games into the season. It's the only big injury he had during his career. Second, he returns in the middle of March, helps the Bulls get into the playoffs, then averages 43.7 points per game, one of those games being his famed 63 points in Boston Garden. And third, after the 63-point game, Larry Bird sums up Jordan's performance by saying, "I think he's God disguised as Michael Jordan." If Larry Bird calls you God, it ain't that far away from God calling you God, you know what I'm saying? The Very Great Michael Jordans. Season 1984-85. Advanced stats. Win shares, 14.0. Box plus minus, 8.2. Value over replacement player, 8.1. Player efficiency rating, 25.8. Per 100 possessions, 35.5 points, 8.2 rebounds, 7.4 assists, 1.1 blocks, 3.0 steals. Team playoff success. Lost to the Bucks in the first round. 3-1. Awards, Rookie of the Year. Jordan's first season in the league was wildly successful. Regarding rookies, his 14.0 win shares are still the 8th most ever. By comparison, Kobe Bryant's win shares his rookie year was 1.8. LeBron tallied 5.1. His per-game scoring average is the 7th highest, 28.2. And his value over replacement player is the highest ever. So it was for sure obvious that Jordan was going to be special, because by most accounts he already was when he arrived. But he wasn't anywhere near what he eventually became. Season, 1996-97. Advanced stats. Win shares, 18.3. Box plus minus, 6.7. Value over replacement player, 6.8. Player efficiency rating, 27.8. Per 100 possessions, 41.8 points, 8.3 rebounds, 6.0 assists, 0.8 blocks, 2.4 steals. Team playoffs success. Beat the Bullets, 3-0, then the Hawks, 4-1, then the Heat, 4-1, then the Jazz to win the title, 4-2. Awards, Finals MVP. A very great year and season that gets pulled into a singular version of itself by the gravity of the flu game. The Very, Very Great Michael Jordans. Season, 1986-87. Advanced stats. Win shares, 16.9. Box plus minus, 8.6. Value over replacement player, 8.8. Player efficiency rating, 29.8. Per 100 possessions, 46.4 points, 6.6 rebounds, 5.8 assists, 1.9 blocks, 3.6 steals. Team playoffs success. Lost to the Celtics in the first round, 3-0. Jordan begins to truly start flexing. He wins his first of 10 career scoring titles, doing so by averaging 37.1 points per game. He also leads the entire league in player efficiency rating, win shares, and value over replacement player. This is also the year that RoboCop, Predator, Lethal Weapon, and The Running Man came out. It doesn't have anything to do with Jordan, but it just seems like a thing I should mention. Season, 1989-90. Advanced stats. Win shares, 19.0. Box plus minus, 10.6. Value over replacement player, 10.1. Player efficiency rating, 31.2. Per 100 possessions, 42.7 points, 8.8 rebounds, 8.1 assists, 0.8 blocks, 3.5 steals. Team playoffs success. Beat the Bucks, 3-1, then the 76ers, 4-1, then lost to the Pistons in the conference finals, 4-3. Big playoff success here, both for his Bulls, one game within making the finals, and for himself. His 36.7 points per game in the 1990 playoffs is still the most in NBA history by a player in a playoff run of 15-plus games. The Bulls end up getting obliterated in Game 7 in the conference finals against the Pistons, but it's hardly Jordan's fault. He puts up 31 points, 8 rebounds, 9 assists. Pippen, who suffered a migraine before the game, puts up 2 points, 4 rebounds, 2 assists, which sounds less like a basketball stat and more like a middle school soccer team's record. Season, 1991-92. Advanced stats. Win shares, 17.1. Box plus minus, 8.6. Value over replacement player, 8.3. Player efficiency rating, 27.7. Per 100 possessions, 39.4 points, 8.4 rebounds, 8.0 assists, 1.2 blocks, 3.0 steals. Team playoffs success. Beat the Heat, 3-0. Then the Knicks, 4-3. Then the Cavs, 4-2. Then the Trailblazers to win the title, 4-2. Awards. League MVP, Finals MVP. Another MVP. Another title. The Bulls win 67 games during this season, fourth most in league history as of 2016. Add in bonus credits here because, A, at this point in his career, it's only the second time he plays in a Game 7. The Knicks clobbered their way there. And he ends up fucking bodying everybody in it. 46 points, 6 rebounds, 4 assists, 2 steals, 3 blocks. B, this is the year he undresses poor Clyde Drexler in the finals. And C, it's also the year he gives us the iconic Jordan shrug. All important and essential moments for Jordan. Season, 1995-96. Advanced stats. Win shares, 20.4. Box plus minus, 8.6. Value over replacement player, 8.3. Player efficiency rating, 29.4. Per 100 possessions, 42.5 points, 9.3 rebounds, 6.0 assists, 0.7 blocks, 3.1 steals. Team playoffs success. Beat the Heat, 3-0. Then the Knicks, 4-1. Then the Magic, 4-0. Then the Seattle Supersonics to win the title, 4-2. Awards. League MVP, Finals MVP, All-Star Game MVP. This was the first full season Jordan played since his rookie year where he didn't lead the league in value over replacement player. But it's also the 72-win year. So those two things cancel each other out if you want to pick nits about his stats. Season, 1990-91. Advanced stats. Win shares, 20.3. Box plus minus, 10.8. Value over replacement player, 9.8. Player efficiency rating, 31.6. Per 100 possessions, 42.7 points, 8.1 rebounds, 7.5 assists, 1.4 blocks, 3.7 steals. Team playoffs success. Beat the Knicks, 3-0, then the 76ers, 4-1, then the Pistons, 4-0, then the Lakers to win the title, 4-1. Awards, League MVP, Finals MVP. Wins his second MVP trophy. Beats Patrick Ewing and the Knicks, Charles Barkley and the 76ers, Isaiah Thomas and the Pistons, and Magic Johnson and the Lakers to win his first ever NBA championship. Averaging a just plain goofy 30...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?